This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow. Evidence is mounting that Mars was a very, very wet planet billions of years ago. But how wet was it? Oceans, Earth, lakes, rivers? And if it was wet, where did all that water go? Those questions are getting more attention recently with the publication of new research analyzing the red planet's watery history. Joining me now to sort it out for us is Ron Cowan. He is an astronomy writer for Science News. You can find his articles on water and Mars at sciencenews.org. Welcome back, Ron.
Thanks, Ira. Hi.
Lots of evidence for water. What's going on oceans here?
There may be oceans, or there may be just shallow, localized patches of water. It's unclear. I mean, mm-hmm. some of the people go back and forth, even in the new research. Some of the new work is saying that in the northern plains, which is really flat, people have looked at dried up river deltas, and they all seem to be at the same altitude, which is what you'd expect if there was an ocean there that kind of flattened everything. And these people in the June 13th Nature Geoscience say that there could have been an ocean that formed this region like this, and it would have been, I'm going to use meters, but it's a 550-meter deep ocean if we spread across the entire planet. But there's other people, however, who say that, you know, from the chemical evidence, that if there was water, you ought to see a lot of minerals that were altered by water, clays, like the clays we have at the bottom of the ocean. And there are some in the north, and even more so apparently in the south of Mars, but not a lot. And then there are people say, well, you know, there never was an ocean. Maybe there were brief wet periods, maybe up to, say, 10,000 years, and then it stopped. And that may have been good for localized habitats for life, but it was not an ocean, and it may not have been global. So there's people sort of going back and forth or debating on both sides of the issue, really.
Mm-hmm. But one other piece of evidence that they've published was the finding of some what they think may be 40,000 dry riverbeds.
That's right.
That would carry a lot of water, would it?
Right, and that would have been, that's where they get the idea of a 550-meter deep ocean. That's right. But then I know that there are other people like Phil Christensen, who's a scientist who's on many of the Mars missions, saying that, you know, such things like these dried-up riverbeds, well, you might have only needed water for, say, 10,000 years at most to form these, and then somehow it went away. And he just keeps saying that the mineral evidence, the clays and minerals are just, they are there on Mars, but not in large amounts. And there's a mineral called olivine, which is very, very susceptible to being altered by water and changed into other compounds. But there is a lot of olivine on Mars, and that would indicate, yeah, well, maybe there wasn't water because there shouldn't be so much olivine there if there was an ocean. So people agree that 3.5 billion years ago or so, there was some water, but it's not clear how much. What people are telling me, too, is that the Mars Science Laboratory, which is supposed to be launched in late 2011 and land on Mars in 2012, that they should pick a place where there is a little bit of this chemical evidence and, you know, look around there, dig around there, and maybe that may really help settle the question. Or, yeah, go to some of these places, again, where there was localized water and look for life there.
Mm-hmm. So they're saying the only way you're going to really settle it is to send something there.
That's right.
And to dig a hole.
One of these interesting places where they have found these what they call phyllosilicates, which are really clays that have been formed in the presence of water. Go and take a look there, because there's some new research where people have a lot of these places where there is chemical evidence for water. The reason they know that is that impactors have pummeled Mars and excavated through the lava that covers a lot of Mars, excavated deep down and found these chemical signatures of water-altered minerals. And so people are saying, well, go and land there because that might be one of the most interesting places for life and to tell exactly how much water was there and when.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the question is, if there was this much water there,
mm-hmm.
where did it all go?
Right. That's true, too. Now, some of it may have evaporated. Some of it may be now beneath the surface, maybe just beneath the surface. And some of it may have migrated or frozen at the poles. All of that is maybe true. And, you know, people have suggested drilling into Mars, and some of these frozen deposits of water may not be that far beneath the surface.
Mm-hmm.
But that is also still a puzzle, yes.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything that looks like a shoreline that would be left over?
Yes. Some people say in the northern parts of Mars, in the northern plains, there are what looks like shorelines. And other people are debating that and saying, well, maybe, and then saying, okay, these may look like shorelines, but then why don't we see all these water-altered mm-hmm. Clays that should mm-hmm. accompany that?
Now, but wouldn't you, if you just think it through a little bit about how the Earth got to be wet, right? And the theory now is that there were comets carrying water, things like that, to our mm-hmm. surface. Well, Mars is almost the same size as
right.
Earth. Wouldn't we think it would be bombarded with the same kind of comets creating oceans and water like that?
Right. Or those there was a early period when Earth and Mars and a lot of the inner solar system was bombarded by asteroids and comets. And what some people say is, yes, that may have been when water was delivered, but it may have been just to localize places on Mars. And yes, Earth has these oceans. It may be that Mars never had oceans, that it was just small areas where maybe it melted the ice where these impactors came, and there was a wonderful habitat for a short time, and maybe it was, though short, long enough for life to have gotten a foothold, but then it got cold again after this period of intense bombardment, which we think happened about 3.9 billion years ago, ended. So, yeah, yes, there could have been water delivered in the same way.
It seems to be logical, but of course science is not logical in many aspects.
Right. No, it's just that people are, I think there's this tension, as I said, between
yeah.
all these wonderful-looking, intriguing dried-up riverbeds and deltas and things that look like much bigger than our Grand Canyon that
right.
presumably were carved by water on Mars, and yet we don't see the chemical compounds mm-hmm. pervasively that we think should be there. Now, some people say that, you know, Mars was so much blanketed over by lava that we don't have a whole lot of windows deep down to where these water-altered minerals may be hiding.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's the answer. Maybe it is more widespread, and we just don't see it because we don't have that many places where more recently asteroids gouged into the surface and exposed these regions.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, again, that's why they're saying, you know,
you got to go there and
you got to pick a really great place for the lander.
Yeah. Are the Mars rovers that are there are not, you know, not made to do that?
That's right. They're not, I mean, they're just more very much on the surface, and they can just sort of scratch the surface a bit. They do go to places where there have been excavations, and they have found definitely some evidence of water sulfates, which are water altered minerals. But we'd now like to go to a place where these phyllosilicates, as they call them, have really been exposed by big impact craters.
Would they be easily landable places, or would we be taking a chance?
That might be somewhat of a challenge, but I think that there. But some of these places, I think, are on NASA's target list, or there are planetary scientists telling NASA that these would be interesting places to take a look, and it would be worth it to consider it as candidate landing sites. Yes,
mm-hmm. And we still have orbiters looking down.
Sure. Yeah.
The Europeans have had their missions.
We Mars have Express. Right. And in fact, some of the recent evidence for, in fact, finding some chemical compounds like clays in the north for the first time were found by Mars Express, and I think NASA's Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter both, and that was actually a paper in the June 25th Science saying that, now, you didn't need an ocean to do this, but mm-hmm. shallow amounts of water were both in the south and the north. So some of this all sounds a bit contradictory, I realize, or a little confusing, but this story is still being played out, really. And what's exciting is, I mean, they're not just arguing, they're arguing with data, and more data is to come. Mm.
And we have to argue only from what we know about what we see here on Earth.
That's true. Right? And the point is that there are places on Earth where we call them hydrothermal vents, where there, you know, there is water and actually high temperature places under in the sea that wouldn't seem to be hospitable for life, but in fact are. Mm. And people are saying even if there was an impact that struck Mars and melted some water for a short amount of time, hey, that might have been good enough for some sort of life to have begun.
Yeah. All right, Ron. Fascinating. Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for taking off from your vacation. For joining us. I know you're on vacation. I
appreciate you saying that. Okay.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. Ron Cowan is astronomy writer for Science News. You can catch his articles at sciencenews.org. And we always thank folks who take off from vacation to be with us. We're going to take a break, and we're not on vacation. We're going to switch gears and talk about a new kind of life. Remember Craig Venter and his... Is Cynthia? Well, there's the president has a panel that he'd like to have them discuss what to do about this new form of life. So we'll stick with us. We'll be right back and talk about synthetic biology. Don't go away.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Bloch.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Last night, the Miami Heat came out on top of the biggest free agent bonanza in NBA history. LeBron James, King James, announced that he was leaving the Cleveland Cavaliers and moving south. In a few minutes, we'll get reaction from people in Cleveland. But first, from member station WLRN in Miami, Kenny Malone brings us a letter for South Florida's new royalty.
Dear King LeBron James, for most of us here in South Florida, last night was fun.
And this fall, man, it's very tough. And this fall, I'm going to take my talents to South Beach.
Oh, my God! I love you, King James! Yes! Thank you, Jesus.
Thanking Jesus and loving the King was Denise Byram. Bringing your talents to South Beach, as you say, you should probably know that sometimes a fun night is followed by a rough morning. And for you, Your Highness, the rough word this morning is expectations. Just ask Heat fan Ruben Seibert.
I expect 1-3 championships would be very well. That's not going on the high end.
Or listen to my colleague Phil Latzman's weekly call-in show.
Could LeBron James and the Miami Heat save South Florida in a civic pride kind of way? Who wants to tackle that?
But it doesn't end there. Because of you, we expect to host at least 9 playoff games a year. For our downtown restaurants to dish out hundreds more chicken wings. And for Ross Tannenbaum to ship thousands more replica jerseys. He owns Dreams Incorporated, one of the biggest online sports merchandise sellers. As a South Floridian, he's excited you're coming. But as a businessman, he could have sold a lot more of the King product if you switched into a bigger, more loyal market like New York or Chicago. So he's hoping you can shatter this town's sports ennui.
Because now the pressure starts, because if you don't win, it's a disappointment. Coming in and losing in the finals, you could also do just as much damage ultimately.
This moment isn't so different than 2004. Shaquille O'Neal headed for the Heat. The sports world was focused on Miami. He was paraded into town atop a giant diesel truck. He sprayed spectators with a water cannon, and he helped win a championship. Your Highness, from you we expect more. Summer is our rainy season, but it's been sunny since your announcement. Just remember, South Florida's subtropical. The weather can change quickly, just like the fans. With love, and for NPR News, I'm Kenny Malone in Miami.
In New York City this week, hundreds of writers, new writers, wannabe writers, and fans have come together for Thriller Fest. It's a four-day gathering that's less about blood and guts and more about the craft of writing and getting published. As NPR's Margot Adler discovered, it's also a chance to get close to some best-selling authors.
The halls of the conference room of the Grand Hyatt Hotel are filled with rooms of writers and would-be writers listening to tips about everything from character development to how to create your ending. Eric Van Lusbader, who has published 5 Jason Bourne novels and took over the series after Robert Ludlum died, told his audience that their characters must have flaws.
Think about your own flaws. Think about the flaws of your enemies. That's even more fun. If you make your character flawed in some way or missing something, missing a piece of him or herself, by the end of the book, they need to be healed. That doesn't mean they're perfect, because nobody's perfect. The human condition isn't perfect, so characters shouldn't be perfect.
The audience is mostly writers. Many have manuscripts they're trying to sell. Some have published nonfiction and now want to try their hand at a thriller. Some tell me they've been mentored by these writers and communicated with them on social networking sites. And why are thrillers interesting? Whitley Strieber's latest thriller is called Omega Point. He says thrillers are the last great escape.
The writer takes you by the hand and leads you down a very dangerous path. And a good thriller, you don't even know he's there. But you do know one thing. You're going to come out all right.
In one room, people are lining up to have their favorite authors sign books. They're all different ages from all over the country. I asked Mike Draper, who is working on a novel, what he's learned.
Having at least 2 plot twists in a novel, and I think mine only has 1, so that's something I have to work on.
Give me one insight you got. I asked J.J. McNabb, who has published some nonfiction but hopes to write a thriller, and Mike Van Blorikum, an engineer who wants to change careers and write.
How to make it so that you're either far away from your characters or really close in. How to develop intimacy or suspense. Wonderful stuff.
The villain needs to be developed just as much as the hero.
Some people are simply looking for publishers and agents.
My name is Todd Honeycutt, and my book is The Shambhala Guardian. It's about a religious fanatic who basically is trying to use American robotic technology and, you know, try to take over the whole world, and Americans who stop him.
For Ken Follett, the best-selling British author of Lie Down with Lions and World Without End, it's his first Thriller Fest.
Yeah, a lot of writers here, some published, some about to be published, and some hoping to be published.
Most surprising is that these big-time authors aren't in green rooms. They're wandering around, speaking personally to people, giving advice, and excited to be teaching them. Again, Eric Van Lusbader, author of The Ninja and those Jason Bourne novels.
This is my 4th time here, and I usually don't like conferences at all, but I love this one because the people who come here are people who really want to write, really can write, and really want to learn.
One aspiring writer told me, there are not a lot of marketing dollars out there. We are very savvy, but we're a little perplexed about the publishing industry now. We are here to get expert help in navigating our careers. Who would have thought that the writers of thrillers would be those experts? Margot Adler, NPR News, New York.
You're listening to All Things Considered. Now that summer is here, some people are turning to gym memberships or miracle diet supplements to get their bodies into beach-worthy shape. We sent musician David Was to the mall to investigate another method for slimming down.
If I actually worked for a living, chances are me and the boys might have had a good time around the water cooler a few weeks ago, rehashing the New York Times story about the new line of Spanx for men. You know Spanx, those hide-the-donut undergarments that press the flesh back to the bones they used to cling to before middle age set in? In Mae West's day, they called them girdles, which no self-respecting feller would think of wearing under his shirt and pants. Women, however, have bought hundreds of millions of dollars worth of Spanx in the last decade. Now men are being invited to wear the boa constrictor shapewear in an attempt to conceal the ravages of life in the fat lane. No stringent diets, no messy surgery. Just slip on the undershirt that embraces you like an old friend and button up your dress shirt over it. Congratulations, sir. You have just lost a virtual 20 pounds. So prepare a response for when your colleagues ask if you've been sick or had some kind of procedure. As NPR's crack underwear sleuth, I ventured to the mall last week to see if I could cajole a department store salesman to feed me a few quotes on this white-hot topic. He took one look at my digital voice recorder and immediately radioed for help. I was escorted upstairs to speak with someone in corporate who confirmed the don't ask policy when it came to floor staff. Eventually, I spoke with the Spanx PR folks directly, who generously offered an interview with the company's founder, Sarah Blakely. Thank you, I said, but I really just wanted to have a down-home, dude-to-dude kind of encounter. Heck, I can't talk underwear with a girl. The final word came down. Spanx would allow me to talk with anyone I pleased, so I returned to the mall only to be rebuffed once again by a corporate handler. Yes, but Spanx said it was okay, I protested weakly, and to no avail. I had apparently reached the barbed-wired, electrified perimeter of the Area 51 of underwear. I shuffled back to the parking lot, crestfallen. My turn as the Seymour Hersh of compression garments had been scuttled by an unfeeling bureaucracy less interested in bulky truth than in looking after their slender corporate image. Did they think I'd fool their salesman into ridiculing the miracle waist eraser? Or that I'd ask sarcastic questions like, if I buy Spanx, can I give up my gym membership? Okay, I admit it. They were right to worry. But after Spanx sent me a free crewneck shirt in the mail, I became something of a true believer. Call me Slim and make mine a double cheeseburger with onion rings.
Musician David Was shops for his supportive undergarments in Los Angeles.
This is NPR.
Now, some big-ticket music acts are discovering that demand for their services is not what they had hoped. As NPR's Tamara Keith reports, this summer concert season is littered with canceled shows.
Please don't stop the music.
That's what Rihanna's fans in Phoenix and Dallas are probably saying. The singer canceled 5 dates on her tour. She's in good company, though. Lilith Fair, The Eagles, and American Idol Live have all trimmed back their tours this summer. Idol's concert promoter Live Nation didn't give a reason, but slow ticket sales are a likely culprit. That's what forced the Country Throwdown Tour to cancel 4 of its dates. Kevin Lyman is the tour's founder.
I think it's an indication of a rough summer. I think it's a bit of the economy. I think it's a glut of everyone on the road all at once, trying to make up for the revenues that they're not making on their records.
Lyman is also the man behind the punk rock Vans Warped Tour. This year, he says business is down 8 to 10% in most markets.
We're seeing a dynamic shift in the touring industry, and I think we'll probably come out stronger in the long run. But right now, some real hard times.
The industry trade publication Pollstar says compared to this time last year, gross income from the nation's top 100 concerts is down 17%. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Washington.
The alphabet has only 26 letters. With these 26 magic symbols, however, millions of words are written every day.
That sound can only mean it's time for Science Diction, our monthly history of scientific words. Now, what we're going to pick today? Genome. It's an active part of our scientific vocabulary. It's defined as all of our genetic information. Maybe some of you are thinking of having your sequenced. We talked about it earlier today. Howard Markel is professor of history of medicine at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, also director of the Center for the History of Medicine there. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Well, it's great to be back, Ira.
Howard, where does that word genome come from?
Well, you know, most of our genetic terminology comes from the Greek word genesis, which means origin or creation. But when it comes to genome, we have to give a botanist from the University of Hamburg, his name was Hans Winkler, all the credit. He was writing a textbook on botany in 1920, and he collided the German word for gene, which is gene, with the Greek suffix ome, which indicates body. Now, this was a very common concoction back then. There's biome and rhizome for a system of roots, and of course, chromosomes, which actually means colorful bodies, because they had a propensity to pick up specific dyes then in use when you were peering at cells through a microscope. But he used the word genome exactly as you define the entire chromosome set to specify the material foundations of our species. Mm-hmm. And it really caught on particularly after 1953 when Watson and Crick most famously described the structure of DNA, and geneticists a few years later began to describe the genomes of several viruses and more complex organisms. And by the late 1980s and officially in 1990, the United States Department of Energy and the National Institutes of Health set out to describe the 3.3 billion base pairs that comprise our human genome and its genetic repertoire.
I guess ome, meaning a body, is a better suffix than something meaning a map.
Exactly,
right?
Because a map is really a two-dimensional structure. It doesn't really tell you, it may tell you how far something is from something else, but it won't tell you about the hills that you may encounter or the valleys or the climatic conditions and so on. And we really want to know how that chromosome set interacts with the protoplasm, what's around it, the proteins, the molecules, and so on.
Mm-hmm. Hey, is the habit of putting the word ome on, was that back 30 years ago, was that very common, adding that suffix?
Absolutely. As I said, there were all these wonderful words concocted between 1900 or 1890 and 1930, and a biome is the one that we use most commonly. And the coelom, a system of cavities, and so on. So it's very common, and now we see proteomics and so on. It's still going on. Now, what's very interesting to me as a historian is what will be the future of a genome. You know, it's come, it's in everybody's vocabulary, and it's come to represent the holy grail of modern medicine, a tool that will help us reveal the cause, cure, and even prevention of diseases. But of course, future assessments of that word will rely on the scientific community's ability to figure out such closely guarded secrets.
Is there another suffix like ome waiting in the wings?
I'm sure there are. And I'm sure there's a number of words that are ready to be concocted. But the thing about genome, scientists love precise words. And if you use genetic map, I actually asked a number of people who were in the room, so to speak, when the Human Genome Project was developed, and they said there was no other word we would ever have come to because there was nothing else quite as precise. So the great thing about making up words is that you can make them mean whatever you want them to mean.
And how long did genome take, to be accepted?
Well, it started in 1920, but by the 1950s, it was really catching on. And certainly as soon as the structure of the double helix was understood and that different base pairs react differently with proteins and molecules and so on, that you needed to know that three-dimensionality to predict what the repertoire would be of things that are functional and not so functional for that matter, scientists adopted it right away.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Howard.
Thank you.
Have a good weekend. Howard Markell is professor of history of medicine at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor and director of the Center for the History of Medicine there. We were talking about the word genome. If you've got a better word, go to our website at sciencefriday.com and click on a comment. Leave us a comment what you think might be a better word than genome. Maybe we can force it into the Oxford English Dictionary somewhere along the line. Might take a little bit, so please be patient. That's about all the time we have for today. Greg Smith composed our theme music, and we had help from NPR librarian Kim Molesky. If you missed any part of our show, you can take it along with you. You can now download our iPhone app for instant access to our Science Friday videos and our Science Friday audio podcasts. Also, you can follow us on Twitter. We're tweeting all week long at SciFry, at SCIFRI. And, of course, you can follow us on Facebook. And also our website, leave a conversation and comments about the program and anything else you'd like to talk about. Have a great weekend. I'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.